And the Nazi officials in Vilna arranged a scientific debate between Shapshal and the Jewish historian Zelig Kalmanovich, who wrote quite a bit about life during the ghetto times. There's a revolution eventually in Iran. He is expelled from the country in 1908. I forgot to mention that in addition to all his other day jobs, he was also a Russian spy. They were of the opinion that it is permissible to fast on Shabbos, and they don't really care what the sages ruled, said, or did not say, which means that in the subtleties of this Zemer, you find both history and halacha. The woman is distraught, both by the possibility that she may have to divorce her husband and that her children may now be mamzerim, may now be considered illegitimate.
Welcome to History for the Curious. I'm Mena Reisner, and I host the internationally renowned lecturer, dynamic historian, and tour guide, Rabbi Aubrey Hirsch. Experience our history, confront dilemmas, and reveal the untold stories of 3,000 years of Jewish heritage, from Paris to Cairo, from the Russian Tsar to Maimonides, and from the Sinai Revelation to the French Revolution. Join the fastest growing Jewish history podcast in the world by subscribing to this channel and discovering the events that have shaped us into who we are today. Rabbi Hirsch, welcome back from yet another trip to Lithuania this time.
Yes.
I've seen in your calendar quite a few Lithuanian trips coming up. It seems like that's probably the most popular choice of destination for shuls. Is there a specific reason for that?
I don't think it is the first choice. That tends to be Poland, but I think a lot of shuls, especially in the area here, have now done that. And if you're going to do a men's only trip, Lithuania often is the one that comes to mind. It's a place of, you know, Torah, Kfarim, the Holocaust, obviously. So I guess that might be the reason. Although, having said that, we are going to be covering Lithuania in this podcast as well.
So we are now going to be doing the third and final installment on the Karaites. But just before we start, I want to tell the listeners that we have a very exciting podcast coming up. We yesterday interviewed Douglas Murray in London, and it was a fascinating interview ranging from topics like the bias in journalism, you know, what the future could look like there in the Middle East and the British government and much more. So make sure you subscribe. You don't want to miss it. Douglas is a very captivating and eloquent speaker. And this is actually our first podcast that will be available on YouTube too. So we will let you know how to access it. And back to this week's The Karaites.
So we end this three-part series with some of the perhaps strangest elements regarding the Karaites, what happened to them in the 20th century and where they are today, the halachic realities of that. But perhaps to start with the 500 years spent in the one country that we haven't covered. Possibly the last place you'd expect Karaites would be in Ponovich. Now, admittedly, I'm not referring to the yeshiva in Bnei Brak, but to the town in northern Lithuania. But even then, it's not a name you would automatically associate. But for 500 years, there was, and in some way still is, a Karaite community there. And legend, in fact, tells us that in 1218, the Grand Duke of the Duchy of Lithuania went to war against the Tatars, defeated them, invaded Crimea, and carried away many prisoners, including 480 entire Karaite households. Bringing them to Lithuania, he settles 330 of them in the town of Troki or Trokai near Vilna, and the remaining 150 in Ponovich. Now, it's true. It's definitely the case that in Trokai, which is halfway between Vilna and Kovna, and in Ponovich, there are early Karaite records. And in fact, Trokai was the capital city of Lithuania before Vilna. But the account of 1218 is, shall we say, implausible. Witold ruled in 1392, not 1218. And 480 Karaite families, that's, I don't know, 2,000 people, and far too high for the time. So it's unlikely There's a second, more plausible origin story, still quite old, based on a written document, which is from 1668, a letter of complaint from the Lithuanian Karaites to the Rabbanites in Brest-Litovsk, Brisk in other words, which reads that for 400 years and even longer, our ancestors expanded their borders in Troki. So that would have them still being there in the late 13th century. Now, whether we take this as a literal 400 years or not, it's definitely the case that the Karaites had legal residence in Trakai before the Orthodox had the ability to live legally in Vilna. And in fact, that the Karaite cemetery was the burial ground even for the Orthodox, which means that the first cemetery in Lithuania, the Jewish one, was a Karaite one. And the presence of the Karaites in Trakai had not just independent community, but an entirely separate town. Because Trakai, if you've ever been there, it's a very pretty town. It's naturally divided by water, and they occupied one part as a town of their own. Now, in 1483, the elders of Trakai write to the Constantinople Karaites for spiritual guidance because they describe a negative state of affairs in Lithuania. I quote, "In the land of Ruthenia, scattered and dispersed over the mountains without a shepherd, refraining from understanding God's Torah." This was obviously written in Hebrew, so they use words like "umeizim pnehem keneged haTorah." And they accuse some of their constituents of pursuing imaginary successes, in other words, mundane life, and regarding them as essential. And this letter is written in rhyme.
Well, so we have a Karaite letter, you know, looking for Chizuk and Musa.
Yeah, it says there, Nefutzim al hehorim, b'toras Hashem ne'edorim, and in response they're told, you know, unfortunately, there's no scholar able to leave his family and go to Trakai to teach Torah and Chochmah, so they suggest instead that some young people from Trakai come to Constantinople to study the words of Torah, and on their return, v'yarbitzu Torah b'Yisrael, they will, you know, give their wisdom, share their wisdom with others.
Couple of years in yeshiva, maybe.
Yes, that's what it really was. And he promises to provide a quality education, accommodation, other necessities. So, yes, yeshiva. And he says, despite the fact that there's a plague at the moment in the city, he would protect the students in one of the villages. And as for those who are reluctant to keep their religious customs, those offenders in town in Trakai, they should be judged by Torah and, if need be, excommunicated. And he said he can't send the copy of Sefer HaMitzvos and the commentary on Tanakh because the Sefer needed to make a copy and he wasn't free at the time. And he suggested that anybody who leaves the house without observing the mitzvah of tzitzis should be fined. They should avoid having vain conversations during prayer. And at the beginning of each festivity, Yontif, I think, and before putting the dead in their orin, in their coffin, you should contemplate and fulfill the instruction in Tehillim, Im Eshkocheich Yerushalayim, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem. And finally, each member of the community should donate 3 coins a month for the purchase of honey to celebrate Kiddush and Havdalah on Shabbos.
Wow, so this is the 15th century and things remain the same for the next few hundred years?
Yeah, I mean, as time goes by, the Orthodox are obviously numerically far greater. They always have been, and they become the majority. So the Karaites end up paying their taxes through the Rabbinate Council, the Vada Arba Rotzis, until 1764, because in the eyes of the non-Jews, these two groups are seen as the Jews. And whatever the internal differences may be, they have to pay to the government as one entity, which obviously is going to cause, you know, machlokes, bitterness, economic competition. Bearing in mind that, in general, everyday relations between the two groups was somewhat, I guess you could say, distant. They might come together when there's a common threat or a common cause, but otherwise not. And they didn't really intermarry between the Orthodox and the Karaites. It's not like Egypt in the Middle Ages. And in fact, in 1928, there is a photo of the large new Karaite synagogue, which they built in Vilna, which still stands to this day. And you have the members sitting outside. And the author of this article writes that even at that stage, not one Karaite had married out of their faith. And he didn't mean out of Judaism. He means out of being a Karaite. They are very different in that sense. And their language and pronunciation is very different. It's Ashkenazi versus Sephardi. They have different texts of prayer and different, culinary dishes, family names. And of course, as we've mentioned, the calendars didn't agree. It's interesting that it is not like reform from both perspectives, as we mentioned in the past. They're not coming to relax the rules of Judaism. On the other hand, ironically, the one area that you could say nowadays that reform does agree with orthodoxy is that they keep the same day of Pesach and or Yom Kippur, and here they don't. Now, interestingly, because the Karaites reject the Talmud, by extension almost, they reject Talmudic names. So you do not have any Karaites called Meir or Hillel or, I don't know, Yehudis. And therefore, if you go to Trakai nowadays, to the Karaite cemetery, you will see of the older tombstones possibly lengthy names from Divrei Hayomim, but you won't see anybody from the times of the Mishnah.
No, that is fascinating. You've shown both this week and earlier in the last two episodes that they were almost religious in their own way, and strongly so, and possibly even more stringent in some ways. Did they ever publish Sforim and books and commentaries on their way of life?
So, in general, I don't think so. I don't know, but I don't believe so. What they're still is one very famous work, rather, which I was going to mention, called Chizuk Emunah. You know, you don't get a title which is more religious sounding than that, strengthening your faith. And it is actually an attack on Christianity and a defense of Judaism, using, of course, only Tanakh, written by a guy called Rabbi, quote unquote, Isaac of Trakai. It's two volumes, 99 chapters, and it demonstrates that the founder of Judaism was not Mashiach. First, he argues if he was really willing to meet such a fate, then
you mean why, the founder of Christianity?
Yes. Then why would the Christians complain? And this is what he was sent here to do. And how can somebody who didn't have the power to save his own life be the savior of all of mankind? And then he asks in the last chapter, how could Christians make such glaring changes? They move Shabbos from the seventh day to the first day. It hasn't been authorized by Yeshua or any of his disciples. It's a real attack defending Judaism.
Oh, did you mention any of this in our Christianity series? The Karaite Sefer?
No, but in general terms, you do have those arguments being voiced in different forms. But it's interesting that he constructed a book purely for that purpose.
Well, they identified as Jews. And
absolutely.
They...
No, but the fact that nevertheless he would go out of his way to do so. And what's interesting is that this was translated into Latin and amongst other languages, and it was used in Christian circles and by freethinkers. Voltaire, for instance, to give you an idea of how broadly it was known, he writes about it that le rabbin Isaac a rassemblé toutes les difficultés, all the questions that we have on Christianity, they're all in this book.
And who is this fellow, Isaac of Trakai? Do we know anything about him? Did he learn? He sounds like a smart fellow.
Well, I mean, he was definitely a scholar, but we know almost nothing about Karaite history that hasn't made it into folklore almost. He was born around 1533. He dies around 1594. But he didn't travel much, and he didn't leave any biographical notes.
If the whole book was just denouncing Christianity, how do we know it wasn't written by someone orthodox? Or was there a lot of Karaite stuff in there?
No, we do have correspondence between him and other Karaites, they ask him Karaite questions, you know, Shalus Atruvus, but not in a way that would provide any further biographical material. So, this is all prior to 1772, when, as we said, in Eastern Europe, very little changes. Then, at that point, most countries in the East, Lithuania, Crimea, most of Poland, are taken over by Tsarist Russia. And then, as we pointed out last time, the Karaites start moving away from the Orthodox, claiming they are a different tribe. They become Russian citizens in 1863. They are not treated as Jews politically, but this will now snowball, because at some stage you need to define, okay, you don't want to be an Orthodox Jew, so what are you? How much of a Russian citizen are you? How far are you willing to go to become one?
Yeah, in essence, freedom always comes at a price.
Absolutely. And then the leader that we mentioned last time, this Firkovich bloke, dies in 1874 and no one obvious takes over. Yes, they continue to pray in Hebrew. They speak the Karaite Turkic dialect. And in fact, in 1897, the number of Eastern European Karaites reaches the highest figure that we are aware of, which is almost 13,000. Other than 200 of them who lived in a town called Halytz, which had now become part of Austria, all the rest are in Tsarist Russia, and therefore the various upheavals of the 20th century are going to leave the Karaites with an ultimate decision to make. 1,100 years of existence is now about to be put to the test. Jewish identity versus conformity. And in fact, conformity wins out, which changes everything. Initially, it's propelled by, you know, the same reason that Jews in the late 1800s in Germany or Hungary assimilated, and in the Crimea, where Karaites are economically very well off in the 1880s and 1890s, and therefore the Tsarist government isn't seen as the enemy. They become increasingly secular, as they did in Germany and Hungary, generally I'm saying the Jews, and they supported the status quo with the Tsarist government at a time where Orthodoxy, or the Jews of Eastern Europe generally, are becoming Bundists and even revolutionaries, and Jewish politics is becoming communist. So the Karaites want a divorce from, well, minimally Jewish politics, although perhaps not from Jewish faith initially. And then you move into the 20th century where European Karaites are no longer very knowledgeable about religion. So the Karaite religion will be hijacked.
Why aren't they knowledgeable anymore?
Well, they are leaderless. They are now geographically further spread out, and they are going to go the way of most other deviant branches of Judaism, and eventually will affect their halachic status as well. Perhaps to illustrate all that I've said and to answer your question further, there is one person who in many ways is the de facto leader of the new secular nationalist Karaite movement, a guy called Saraya Shapshal. And he's born in 1873, dies in 1961. He will de-Judaize the Karaite movement. I guess he can best be described as a soldier of fortune. In 1901, he's appointed as the personal tutor of the Iranian crown prince, Mohammad Ali Shah. This person now eventually will become the king, and Shapshal becomes a minister in his court, an advisor in Iran. He earns the nickname Bloody Shapshal, because he urged the Shah to crush the Iranian constitutional movement, however many people that would kill. And there's a revolution eventually in Iran. He is expelled from the country in 1908. I forgot to mention that in addition to all his other day jobs, he was also a Russian spy, very busy guy. And he comes back to the Russian Foreign Office. He's now teaching Turkish in St. Petersburg University. But the irony is that despite his lack of religious education or traditional way of life, but because of his connections with the Russian government, in 1911, he is offered the position of becoming Chacham of the West Russian Karaites, which by now is more of a political position than a spiritual one. But he encounters strong opposition amongst the Karaite population. They don't want him as a leader. This impasse is resolved, shall we say, in 1915, where he is now installed as the Chacham. And he is interested in integration, not tradition. So he starts by changing, by reforming that which exists. One of them was the complete exclusion of the Hebrew language and literature from the curriculum of any Karaite schools. Now, he is going gung-ho, full speed with his reforms, and then there's a communist revolution. And he has to flee because he was part of the infrastructure, and he now escapes to Istanbul. But he is clearly a cat with at least nine lives, so that somehow, even though he had originally found favour with the Tsarists, which was an ongoing death penalty, he convinces the Bolsheviks now that it's in their interests to install him back into a position of power, especially now that atheism has become the official state policy in Soviet territories. He will remove Judaism from the Karaite tribal tradition. And in 1928, he is elected as the Chacham of the Polish-Lithuanian Karaites. And from now until the end of his life, some 35 years later, he will live in Trakai in Lithuania.
But what's that even mean, the Chacham of a religious group, if his whole mission was to completely eradicate Judaism from it?
Okay, so he will now invent a radically new history, just like Firkovich did, but there it was much more in theory. Here he will put it into play in practice. He removes Hebrew, not just from the schools now, but from the synagogue liturgy and on matzevos, on tombstones. It's now Latin letters. He invents two new holidays, and he will give new names to the months of the year. In fact, he goes as far as to, first of all, recognize both Yeshu and Muhammad as prophets, and he introduced paganism, you know, the veneration of sacred oak trees in the cemetery. In fact, the word synagogue was now banned, and it's replaced by the word kinesia or kinesa, which is how it's referred to today in Lithuania. And he says that the Karaites are descendants of Turkic tribes. They have no historical affinity whatsoever to the Jewish people.
I don't get this. I mean, the Karaites viewed themselves as being very religious. How did they go along with all of this?
So, the very religious element, as we said, starts being encroached upon over the last 30 years of the 19th century due to assimilation, due to ignorance, due to a lack of leadership. And then this is imposed upon them. And you have to realize you're living in communist times. The Karaites couldn't oppose him, definitely not openly, given his official standing. Now, obviously, it wasn't the case that all European Karaites accepted his doctrines. Some, what they call Chachamim of the population, preserved their Jewish heritage. But these traditional Karaites were in the minority. It's interesting, obviously, because this parallels what's happening in the Orthodox world, where percentage-wise, over half of Orthodoxy defects away from Orthodoxy in the last half of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century.
And that was for the same reason, because becoming more and more uncomfortable to be Jewish in Europe at that time.
Yes. The one thing I would say that didn't exist is that they weren't leaderless in Orthodox Judaism, but there were far more pressures and they were larger in number. They were more of a target.
Right.
They were more visible entity. So, yes, they have a communal existence and ritual, but they are no longer the Karaites that were. And then you get the Holocaust. Now, bearing in mind that, let's say, in Lithuania, 94% of the Jewish population was wiped out. So after the Nazis invade Lithuania in June 1941, this Shapshal meets with the German authorities and convinces them that the Karaites are not Jewish. And the Nazi officials in Vilna arranged a scientific debate between Shapshal and the Jewish historian Zelig Kalmanovich, who wrote quite a bit about life during the ghetto times. He was in the Vilna ghetto. He was eventually murdered by the Nazis. And Kalmanovich goes out of his way to convince the Nazis that Karaites are not Jews, because he understands that if he says that they are, he's signing a communal death warrant for the Karak community.
Leads on to a fascinating halachic discussion if one is allowed to do this or not.
Right. So technically in halacha, generally the answer is no.
Right.
In fact, I came across a fascinating essay about that recently, going all the way through from the Middle Ages to the Nazi period and beyond, to what extent you can say something that is non-committal, that can be interpreted one way or the other. But otherwise, to say a definitive statement is generally osa in halacha.
Right.
Now, the German Ministry of Internal Affairs, they had to deal with all these sort of racial questions, quote unquote. They agreed to it. And in 1942, they extend it to cover the Karaites in the Ukraine and in Crimea. And they get a special identity card, which means that although some Eastern European Karaites were killed during the Holocaust, the vast majority were spared. In fact, there is a diary that was kept by a non-Jewish Pole, which details the massacres that took place in the forest in Ponar, just outside Vilna. The diary is almost day by day for 18 months. And on August 19th, 42, I believe, he writes, "A Karaite was taken from the street and already in the execution pit when he turned to one of the Germans claiming that he was not a Jew but a Karaite, and he was set free." In other words, he's about to be murdered, and that was a good enough reason for him to be let free.
It's fascinating that the Nazis bought into it. I mean, even according to their laws, the Nazis' laws, if you had only a Jewish father, you were considered Jewish. It's not like they subscribe to, obviously, this is a different argument, but...
Right, so that's the point. They're not saying that my grandfather was Jewish and I now worship in a church. They are saying that none of us were ever Jewish. We come from a different tribe. We just have a fascination with the Old Testament. That's how it was portrayed, and it was bought.
Wow.
So that got them off the hook, but in many ways the relations between the Karaites and the Orthodox was in the nature of a one-way street. There are reports, going back to what you mentioned, of Rabbinite Jews who were refused in their attempts to get the Karaite authorities to list them as members of their community. And according to a survivor from the Lutz ghetto, the Karaites were even called Semitic Nazis by the local Orthodox. And in the last year of the war, a number of Karaites were recruited or compelled to join as volunteers in Waffen-SS battalions. One Karaite family from Halitz joined the Banderovtsky, which was a radical movement of Ukrainian nationalists, and killed thousands of Jews and even Poles. And even though the actual numbers of these types of collaborators would definitely have not been more than a few dozen, but the taste it left was bitter.
And what happened to, I forget his name, Shapshal?
Yeah. So he actually lives in his apartment in Vilna throughout the war. He does not get taken into the ghetto, and he is disturbed by neither the Nazis nor by the Russians when they recapture that city in 44. Now, post-World War II, the Nazis are replaced by the communists ruled from Moscow, from the Soviet Union, which persecuted religion in general and Jews in particular. So irrespective now of the fact that you might not be of Jewish origin, but religion is persona non grata. So the Knessets were confiscated, with the exception of Trakai. The ones in Vilna and Lutsk and other places are reused as offices or flats or storehouses. The one in Ponovich was left deserted, and it burnt down in 1970. The Karaite school was closed down. Basically, all you have left visibly is the graveyards in Trakai and Vilna. And of course, this is going to be the final nail in the coffin for a continuation of European Karaites as a Jewish movement. And they stopped practicing circumcision to the degree, in fact, that in the 1970s, when some Jews were allowed to emigrate, and it was only Jews, the Karaites didn't claim Jewish status. And statistically speaking, in 1979, within the Soviet Union, there are 3,341 people who declare the Karaite religion to be their nationality, I guess. 138 lived in Vilna. This is pretty much the number that is the case 20 years later. There are 75 in Trakai. There are around 30 or 40 in Ponovich, which is more than the amount of Jews that Oren Ponovitch at the time, you know, after the Holocaust, etc. And by 1997, out of 43 children, only three can actually speak this Turkic language, which they learnt at home. So there are very few traditional Karaites left. This is the result of the, you know, of the communists. Now, after the fall of the Soviet Union in 91, there are very liberal interpretations given to the Israeli law of return. And therefore, a number of these Eastern European Karaites moved to Israel, a few hundred. Paradoxically, Yuri Shapshal, who's the great-grandson of the father of the, you know, Karaite Turkic identity, but they're not really Jewish. They are pretty much Christian, and they will emigrate with Christian spouses and family. Within Lithuania itself, you could talk about two last places where there's a little ember of the old, of traditional Karaite religion still being practiced, one of which is in Trakai.
So it's pretty much over by the sounds of it.
It is pretty much over in Eastern Europe. But more importantly, there is another branch of the Karaites, far more loyal to their traditional roots, and that's the Middle East. We left them 2 weeks ago, but they're still there. And, you know, the Karaite population of Cairo, for instance, grew from about 200 in the 1820s to 2,000 in the 1870s and over 5,000 in the 1930s. And in fact, even after the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, most Egyptian Jews remained in Egypt, as did the Karaites. And the Karaite newspaper, Al-Kalim, continues to publish. It's the only Jewish periodical which appears in Egypt after 48. And the last Karaite, Chacham, leaves Egypt after the Six-Day War, as do the Iraqi Karaites. And they will be very traditional in their way of life. You have Moshe Marzouk, who was one of the Egyptian Jews executed in 1954 for planting bombs in Cairo because of instruction from the Israeli military intelligence. To those who are aware of the story, it's the Lavon affair. He was a Karaite, and he's considered a hero in Israel, but his Karaite identity is actually downplayed in Israeli newspapers. They just describe him as an Egyptian Jew until 2001, when the Israeli government, through the postal authority, issued a special set of stamps honoring him and many other Karaite Jews that gave their lives for Israel.
So today, real non-diluted Karaites, how many do we have?
Over 30,000.
Wow, that's yes, a lot more than I expected.
Okay, so let's go from the smaller communities to the larger. There are probably 80 Karaites in Istanbul in Turkey, and they still have a Karaite synagogue there, Kahal HaKadosh B'nai Mikra. There are 1,800 in Europe, mostly in Ukraine and Crimea, where there are 800. There are 350 in Poland, in and around Warsaw and Wrocław. Don't know if you've ever come across them in your trips there. I actually have not. Maybe I'll make a point of it next time. There are still 200 in Lithuania, mainly in Trakai and Vilna. Switzerland has Karaite Jews, and they are recognized by the State of Israel so that they can make Aliyah as Jews. There are 1,500 Karaites in the USA. Not a large number. There's only one functioning Karaite synagogue in Daly City, California, a suburb of San Francisco. But there, in America, in a departure from tradition, because Karaites never allowed non-Jewish converts. And in 2007, they changed, and 10 adults and 4 minors joined the Karaite community, taking the oath that Ruth took. You know, that's what they based it on, because obviously they're dealing with Tanakh once again. They don't have a Shulchan Aruch that's telling you how to convert, and they'd never allowed it.
But conversion is written in the Torah, which they believe in.
Yes, but for some reason they
didn't adopt it.
Yeah, and you don't really have, you might have the allowance of it, but you don't have people going out to do so. You have narrative rather than halacha, and that's how they saw it. But the largest Karaite communities over around 30,000, is in Israel. They have communities in Ramle, in Ashdod, and Beersheba. I think Ashdod is the largest. And they are Arabic-speaking, often, of Egyptian extraction. And they did not lose their tradition, unlike their Eastern European brethren. They are called the Universal Karaite Jews, and they have a chief rabbi by the name of Moshe Firuz. And the head of the group describes the movement, I guess somewhat grandiosely, as running along parallel tracks to rabbinic Judaism. Anything you can do, I can do better. We have our own rabbis, our own chief rabbi, our own kosher butcher shops, our rabbinical courts, our synagogues, our conversion course. We even have our own moalim. And if you remember from what we described, the Karaite, they are not going to officially eat non-Karaite shechita. So, you know, they are still keeping their way of life. But they follow a patrilineal definition of who's a Jew through the father, which they've always done. Now, it didn't used to make a difference, because fathers and mothers were always Jewish. But that now does have an effect on halacha. And the interesting thing is that nowadays they have egalitarian services, although I'm not sure if that's across the board in all of the communities, because there are 12 different towns in Israel where there is a Karaite kehila, quote unquote.
That's an important piece of information that we have no idea if they're Jewish or not.
Okay, so we'll come to halacha in a moment. Just to complete the picture in Israel, in 2016, World Karaite Judaism opened a visitor center in the Old City, complete with museum and synagogue, so you can find out more there.
I'm sure it's called the WKJ or something.
From the UKJ.
So all in all, a very, very small number, because I was about to ask you, why have I never sort of met one? And they're a tiny bunch
number,
of people.
But somehow still around. And I would guess that without Israel having emerged, they would have died out. They still might, but they still have legal status. And you also have neo-Karaites, meaning people who are Jewish and joined the movement later in life. There was a newspaper article, not from a religious publication a number of years ago, which described the following scene within the last decade, and I quote, "Outside the walls of Jerusalem, Bruce Brill carefully picks apart a single grain of barley. He removes three sets of chaff. He shakes his head in disappointment because in performing an ancient religious rite that occurs annually at the end of the Hebrew month of Adar, the Bible stipulates that only ripe barley may be served as the grain sacrifice that Kohanim used to offer on Passover in the temple," in other words, the Omer. "And until the barley is ripe, Karaites cannot declare Passover," which means that it would have had to have been delayed for that year. But he eventually did find ripe barley last month in Sderot. He informed the Karaite community through WhatsApp, attaching photos as proof, which allowed hundreds of Karaite families to begin to observe the holiday roughly with the rest of the Jewish people. They started on April 6th that year, and we started on April 5th. The article goes on to say that on Passover, some Karaites drink beer, sticking to the letter of the Torah, which says nothing about drinking beer, and they also eat pasta, arguing that it's as unleavened as matzah.
I think you would delight the listeners if you managed to get onto this WhatsApp group and publish the conversations.
Right. I will, however, before I get to the halachic element, end with a vignette from World War I. In August 1914, so most of the Karaite men living in Halitz, which was in Austria, were recruited into the Austrian army. But towards the end of 1914, the Russian army overran the town. They occupy Halitz now. And what happens is, I guess, typically Jewish, because now you have Karaite soldiers and officials from the rival Russian army. And they enter the local Karaite synagogue and attend services there because, you know, a synagogue is a synagogue irrespective of which side of the war you're on. Even to the degree that among the Russian soldiers, there were Muslims who didn't eat pork, and therefore local Karaite women were hired to prepare ritually clean food for them.
That's fascinating. You mentioned earlier that the Karaites have a legal status in Israel, which is interesting in its own right. What is the halachic status nowadays?
Okay, so over the centuries, there have been divergent opinions as to how to treat the Karaites if they wish to return to orthodoxy. The Romans was of the opinion in the 1500s that given that they don't have the laws of gittin, of divorce, there is now a statistical possibility of mamzerus, of illegitimate children from the second marriage, and therefore marriage with Karaites was forbidden. This obviously increases in Crimea and in other places during the 19th century, and there is now the problem of intermarriage as well. So you now have two possible considerations, a doubt regarding mamzerus, regarding yichus, and a doubt regarding maybe if they're not Jewish. So in the early 1950s, the chief rabbinate of Israel objected to a sort of whole-scale immigration of Karaite Jews into Israel from the Middle East and tried to obstruct it. And the grounds were very forcefully articulated by the Tzeliezer in a Truva in Volume 5. And he quotes the following poskim, the Ramah, the Taz, the Vilna Gaon, the Levush, the Orach HaShulchan, the Binyan Tzion, the Chaya Odom, the Mabit, as having at least a sophic to their status, a doubt to their status. And he says that the current poskim, including Chief Rabbi Herzog, Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rav Yushalayim, is being similarly minded. He quotes, Hari Chazinan, Shegam Miyachidei HaPoskim Shehetiru, even those that allowed it, those few poskim that did so, it was only on the condition that they were going to do tshuva and return to orthodoxy. And then he adds, and those that want to bring some sort of proof from the Rambam that is mentioned by the Radvaz and the Shach, as if he was lenient, that once again is under the same conditions, bearing in mind this is a time where they only married Jews. In fact, it would have been unthinkable to do otherwise, possibly even illegal at certain moments. And he ends off with a quote from the Yamshal Shlema, which is the Marshal, Va'ani Shamati, and I heard, Shechochem Gadol Be'eret Yisrael, that a sage, a Talmud Chochem, in Eretz Yisrael, wanted to allow Karaites wholesale to be readmitted into Orthodoxy without qualification, V'nikseru Loi Hashom Min Hashamayim, and his life came to an end. So clearly a matter which is not to be treated lightly. And about 10 years ago, I came across the following responsum. In 2007, the following case was presented to the Beis Din of Budapest. There was a Hungarian girl who'd become a balas tshuva, moved to Eretz Yisrael to attend seminary, and subsequently gotten married to a Sephardi bal tshuva in 2004. In 2007, they now have two children, and they are informed by his parents that they were actually Karaites from Egypt. And of course, the woman is distraught, both by the possibility that she may have to divorce her husband, and that her children may now be mamzerim, may now be considered illegitimate. And she therefore goes to the Beis Din and asks what to do next. So in a very long piece, and based on the consideration that at least three other Bote Din will agree to this reasoning, which they did, he allowed her to remain married and for the children to be given the status of Yisrael Ksherim. And the four considerations were, firstly, that she was already married, which in cases of doubt regarding lineage often has different rules in halacha, for instance, gerus and kahuna. Secondly, that she and her children undergo gerus l'chumra, which Rabbi Yaakov Emden would consistently allow with regards to Karaites. And now even the other opinions that we quoted would only view this issue of possible mamzerus as rabbinic rather than biblical, which once again has leniencies in halacha. Thirdly, the fact that he was living away from Egypt and away from any Karaite communities, and in a similar halachic ruling, the Noid Behuda had been mater, had allowed it on the basis of kol de porish meruba porish, for those in the Talmudic sukya, And finally, that he was originally from Egypt, his parents were from Egypt, where the Radvaz ruled that their marriages and divorces don't create halachic problems because they didn't intermarry with non-Jews. So all in all, this gave grounds for the marriage to continue. And we will close today with the Evan Ezra. You may remember that a number of weeks ago, I sort of left a teaser for the listeners and said that we will come back to the Evan Ezra at some point.
Yeah, I've barely been able to sleep.
I can imagine, yes. Well, no, we did have some loyal listeners who actually emailed with...
Followed up
yes,
on it.
With various yes. suggestions. Actually, it refers to the Karaites. You will remember that he fought against the Karaites and that he also composed the Zemer that we sing on Shabbos, Ki Eshmer Shabbos. It is less well known that within that there are a number of specific anti-Karaite references. And when the Karaites reproduced it, reprinted it, they changed one of the paragraphs, in particular the fifth one. The Evan Ezra originally wrote, and that's what we normally sing, Espalalar el Kael Arvis v'shachris, I will pray to God both in the evening and in the morning, Musaf v'gam mincha huyaneni, and adds that I also, on the Shabbos, will have the Musaf prayer and mincha. But you may remember that Karaites only pray twice a day, and therefore they had to edit out that second part so that they just say, I will call out Lekel Elyoin ki yaneni. Interestingly, the third paragraph, which was also a polemic against the Karaites, was missed. They didn't sort of notice it, where he writes, Alkein lehisanes boi alpin nevoinov osur, that it is forbidden to fast on Shabbos in accordance with the Chachamim, with the sages. Now, both of these would sort of irk the Karaites. They were of the opinion that it is permissible to fast on Shabbos, and they don't really care what the sages ruled, said, or did not say, which means that in the subtleties of this Zemer, you find both history and halacha, and it goes obviously unnoticed generally, and I have here a reprint of the Karaite version of Ki Eshmer Shabbos, printed in Vilna, where you can see the changes.
Perhaps we should upload it on the description of the podcast, so our listeners could see. Rabbi Hirsch, thank you so much. That brings our Karaite series to a close. I think one of the reasons for the popularity of these podcasts is the level of detail and research you do, especially on less well-known parts of history. And I think this series was one of them. Who knew so much about the Karaites? So certainly not me. Please subscribe and give it 5 stars to allow other listeners to find it. And make sure you don't miss the Douglas Murray episode, which will be also available on YouTube. And following that, there will also be an interview with a soldier who gives a very personal account of his experiences in Gaza. So please subscribe that you don't miss any of that. Thank you, Rabbi Hirsch, and good night.